everyone, ladies and gentlemen from far and near. Welcome and thanks for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren. We are based out of Sweden, by the way. If you're new to the program, have a closer look at redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com for more radio, videos, and news on all the topics that we investigate and discuss. Brian Kennard is behind Grave Distractions Publications. In 2009, he finished his first book, Skullduggery, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead. Today, however, he is with us to discuss his latest, Steinbeck, Citizen Spy. After languishing in the CIA archives for 60 years, a letter is discovered in John Steinbeck's own hand that shatters everything history tells us about the author's life. Written in 1952 to then CIA director Walter Bedell Smith, Steinbeck makes an offer to become an asset for the agency during a trip to Europe later that year. More shocking than Steinbeck's letter is Smith's reply, accepting John's proposal. Discovered by Brian Kennard, these letters create the tantalizing proposal that John Steinbeck was, in fact, a CIA spy. Utilizing information from Steinbeck's FBI file, John's own correspondence, and interviews with Thomas Steinbeck, his son, Edward Albee, a former CIA intelligence officer, and others, Steinbeck, Citizen Spy, uncovers the secret life of American cultural icon and Nobel Prize winner John Steinbeck. Stay with us for more. Well, hi and welcome, Brian. Nice to have you with us. Thanks for coming on the program, first of all.
Glad to be on. Thank you, too.
You bet, Brian. This is going to be interesting. It's a very interesting story that you brought to our attention that you've been researching here. Just how long you can explain yourself, but this is yet another example, of course, of how we think that the people that we read, authors and playwrights, are independent in their thoughts, but clearly not. Some are converted, of course, by ideology, while others are influenced more directly by intelligence services to start working for them. Sometimes both, of course, but it's clear that it's a war of intentions at every turn, and that our most, if not all, of our beloved storytellers use their position of popularity and prominence to influence the masses, if you will, didactic, as I mentioned before to you. Authors and playwrights in place, are trying to impose, or teach, particular morals, instructions, ulterior motives, etc. Who is working for whom kind of thing. But before we talk more about John Steinbeck and who that was and everything, Brian, maybe you can just give us an outline a little bit of how you wanted to go into this, or why. I mean, you dug into the archives of the CIA to get information on him. How did this happen, Brian?
It actually started on a weekend trip that I take every year with a group of buddies of mine. And we were in a used bookstore in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And I knew about as much about John Steinbeck as any high school, college graduate does. You're forced to read, The Grape's Wrath or Chrysanthemums or Mice and Men. And I had kind of been reintroduced to Steinbeck by his books Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday, which are actually comedies, and a pretty far departure from his other works. So I was looking through the Steinbeck section, and I noticed two books sitting on the shelf. One of them was The Acts of King Arthur and His Noble Knights, which was a retelling of Sir Thomas Malory's L'Amour d'Arthur, and a book called The Short Reign of Pepin the Fourth, which was a political satire that Steinbeck wrote and was published in 1957, and deals with the monarchy coming back to France, and specifically the Merovingians ascending the throne. So we know each other through my Grail Seeker blog, which woefully I leave untended these days because of my publishing business. But so Arthurian legend and Grail lore had always interested me, and I thought, wait a minute, there's got to be something here. So I started digging into Steinbeck's background little by little. And in 2008, I spoke with his son for about an hour about John's love of Arthurian legend and some things that Thomas told me, John's son, got me to looking at places like Steinbeck's FBI file and things that Steinbeck did during World War II. And this is an on again, off again thing I'm doing over the years.
Right.
And instead of taking weekend trips to the beach or to the mountains, I would go to archives. I go to the, you know, New York Public Library Special Collection to find or look at Steinbeck's research assistant's notebook from the days that he was doing a majority of the work on the acts of King Arthur and his noble knights, and went to Stanford University and looked through their archives and original letters and that type thing. And I kept having this inkling that there was a lot more to Steinbeck than meets the eye. The tipping point was looking at Steinbeck's FBI file, and anybody can access Steinbeck's FBI file at the FBI's vault website, where they've got hundreds of entertainers and writers and public figures, FBI files for everybody to see that have been cleared under the Freedom of Information Act. And I'd looked at that, gosh, I guess about half a dozen times throughout the course of this. And I decided to look at it one more time and not look at it for content, but so look at it from the angle of who was writing the reports, what information was being requested about Steinbeck by who, and maybe that would tell a story in and of itself.
Right.
Three little letters kept coming up that I can't believe that I've never noticed, and the majority of Steinbeck researchers out there have never really put together either. CIA. At least 20 times in Steinbeck's FBI file, there are redactions for national security purposes or specifically were made by the Central Intelligence Agency. There are two or three whole pages that have been redacted from Steinbeck's file by the CIA. The CIA requests information from the FBI, specifically the Office of Security did in 1957. So I started thinking, why would the CIA be interested in Steinbeck? You know, of course, when he published The Grapes of Wrath, he got hit with the stigma of being a communist sympathizer.
Right.
And that always kind of stuck with him, kind of like the role of a child actor, sticking with someone even throughout their adult career. And Steinbeck did have a number of friends in the American Communist Party, and his first wife, Carol, even joined the Communist Party. I think that was kind of a stick in the eye to John because their marriage was kind of toxic, and at the time, they were about ready to divorce. But Steinbeck had those ties in the communist community and was always thought to be a closet communist. And most people today, that's what their perception of him is. So I thought, well, okay, maybe that's why the CIA was looking into Steinbeck. So I started looking at other people's FBI files, you know, people that were blacklisted, like William Hellman, or people that the CIA might be interested in, like Desi Arnaz. He had ties with the Cuban community and would have been in particular interest to the agency during Fidel Castro's rise from the late 50s to early 60s. None of these people had redactions made specifically at the CIA's request. I even looked at Albert Einstein's FBI file because I thought, surely, you know, Einstein's going to have redactions. And there was one page redacted in Einstein's, gosh, it's 1,500 pages of his FBI file in one sentence. Now, we compare that to Steinbeck's 120-page FBI file and two or three pages of redactions and at least 20 paragraphs. Something's not quite matching up there.
Right.
So at the beginning of 2012, I decided I had exhausted every other resource I could think of. So I thought, why not send a Freedom of Information Act request to the CIA? What do I have to lose? So I requested any and all information they had on John Steinbeck. And the FOIA process is as simple as it is difficult because you have to jump through a ton of hoops to get any kind of information, and you have to be very specific. And when you deal with a person, you've got to actually fill out a form so they can correctly identify the person that you're looking for, including social security number, you know, all sorts of stuff.
Right.
So every month or so, I would get a letter from the CIA saying, hey, we've got your request. Hey, we're processing your request. Hey, we've got something we'll be sending you. And this is over the course of months. And at the time, I was sending off a ton of FOI requests to the FBI, Office of Naval Intelligence, to the CIA, to the NSA. I know my mailman was probably freaking out as I kept getting letters back.
Right.
But it's kind of cool to get a letter from the CIA because it's just a normal, you know, business size envelope, but they put this really thick brown tape on the back of it to make sure that no one's opened it.
Right.
So anyway, in August of 2012, I got another letter from them, and I thought, okay, this is just another, you know, piece in the bureaucratic puzzle. And I open it up, and there's a letter from their Freedom of Information Act coordinator, you know, saying, hey, here's what we've got. Any other information we can't confirm or deny, but here you go. And, you know, it's three or four pages in this entire packet. And I thought, well, this isn't going to be much. And I couldn't have been more wrong, because two of the letters, there were two letters that were in this packet. The first was dated January 28th, 1952, and is written in Steinbeck's own hand on his own letterhead. And I've seen numerous letters of Steinbeck's written on the exact same letterhead that makes an offer to Walter Beadle Smith, who was the director of Central Intelligence at the time. Smith was also Eisenhower's right-hand man during World War II and was the ambassador to Russia in the late 40s. In this letter, Steinbeck says that he is going to be going to Europe for 6 to 8 months, writing a series of articles for Collier's magazine. And he actually makes this as a direct quote. If during this period I can be of any service, whatever, to yourself or to the agency you direct, I shall only be too glad.
Hmm.
And he drops a couple of names like Herbert Baynard Swoop and makes another couple of cryptic references and says at the very end of the letter, again, I shall be pleased to be of service. The pace and method of my junket, together with my intention of talking to a great number of people of all classes, may offer peculiar advantages. Yours sincerely, John Steinbeck. And I thought, well, that's kind of neat. You know, at least it shows intent. Well, the next letter was what really sealed the deal. It was from Walter Beadle Smith back to Steinbeck. And directly from the letter, he says, you can indeed be of help to us by keeping your eyes and ears open on any political developments in the area from which you travel. And in addition, on any other matters which might seem to you of significance, particularly those that might be overlooked in general reports. And Smith goes on to say, hey, drop by Washington before you go. Be sure you talk to us when you come back. Have a nice day. This is about as close to a smoking gun as we're going to probably ever get out of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Right.
But coupled with Steinbeck's background and other things that happened in Steinbeck's life a little later, it shows a pattern of behavior that there's only one conclusion, and that's Steinbeck was a CIA asset.
Right.
So I started fleshing out my manuscript for this, and I'd, you know, had tons of, you know, little tidbits here and there about things that I'd found in his FBI file and other peculiarities within his life that really didn't match up. And finally, once I got that done in February of this year, I finally contacted Steinbeck's son, Thomas, again. I really didn't want to call him up when I first got these letters to say, hey, guess what? I think your dad was a spy.
Right.
You know, you just don't do that to a guy. So I sent him an email and got in touch with his wife, who's also kind of his gatekeeper, and explained my story to her. And she was like, yeah, you need to talk to Tom about this. And she kept asking me, you know, why did you hold off or just not publish this? I said, well, you know, you don't want somebody just to read in the newspaper or hear an interview like this that their father might be involved with the CIA and you might not have known about it. So I talked to Tom and told him my tale, and he listened very, very intently throughout all of it and didn't say a word. And I came to a point where I had gotten another response out of the FBI for another request I'd made to declassify all of Steinbeck's FBI file, hoping that that might shed some other light on all this. And the FBI admitted, and I have the letters in the book, that they have destroyed portions of Steinbeck's FBI file, which is not an uncommon occurrence, it seems. Walter Cronkite's FBI file's been destroyed. Rosa Parks' FBI file's been destroyed. It makes you wonder what the FBI's actually holding back.
Right. Yeah.
So I get to the, I tell Tom about that, and he said, well, what do you think about that? What do you think about the FBI saying they destroyed those files? I said, well, Tom, it's all horseshit. They've got them. They just, you know, have deemed that they're not going to give them up. And he said, that's right. He said, I always knew my dad was up to something. J. Edgar Hoover hated him. And over the next, you know, we talked for about another 30 or 45 minutes, and over the next few months, and still to this day, Tom will call me up every couple of weeks and just kind of chat. And I've gotten a lot of background information from Tom. And unfortunately, Tom was born in 1944. So a lot of this is happening when Tom is a very, very young man. But he was able to shed quite a bit of light on his father's life and some, once again, some peculiar instances that just didn't add up with Tom. And as we talked, I really got this sense that Tom can really neither confirm or deny any of this.
Right.
Because, you know, he doesn't really know. But we did talk one time about, you know, how didn't I see this from Tom's angle? Mm-hmm. You know, my dad is working for the CIA, and I had no idea. I told him, well, Tom, you know, the CIA is arguably the best spy organization the world has ever seen. And they guard their secrets very, very closely and teach their assets to hide things. So how a, you know, 10, 11, 12, 15 year old boy is going to figure out that his dad was in the CIA, there's no shame in that.
Right.
And, you know, I think Tom's kind of come to terms with it, and he's writing his own memoirs now. And I think this has kind of filled in a bunch of pieces for him and made him reevaluate a number of things that he very well didn't have answers to. So if nothing else, that's kind of neat that I've been able to help him out a little bit, maybe, in understanding his father.
Right. So you kind of, have you pieced together a little bit in terms of his story, kind of his journey? I mean, you told me earlier that basically he worked for the OSS, you know, so he's a long tradition and history in these agencies, right?
Yeah, actually, Steinbeck's history with the intelligence services starts about 1940. And that's actually when World War II kind of started for Steinbeck. In March to April of 1940, him and a buddy of his who was a marine biologist named Ed Ricketts went on a marine specimen collecting expedition that later became the basis of the Sea of Cortez. And it was off the coast of in the Gulf of California around the Baja Peninsula. And Steinbeck had actually gotten a friend of his to write President Roosevelt asking if there were, you know, any special permits or anything that they might need, credentials they might need from the State Department to make sure they didn't get in touch with the Mexican government. And the FDR library holds some of these letters and the correspondence that go back and forth, but there's one mention made in this flurry of letters, because nobody really knew how to handle this or knew how to answer Steinbeck's question. So it kind of seemed early on that this was kind of the joke of the office. Oh, we'll send it over to State Department. Oh, the State Department doesn't know what to do with it. We'll send it to the Navy. And a naval captain got a hold of this and makes mention of using Steinbeck for naval intelligence, and says that he will forward Steinbeck's request to the Office of Naval Intelligence for the Navy's purposes. And it's not any clearer than that. So we have one or two conclusions here. One, either Steinbeck was approached by the Office of Naval Intelligence to do something. And at the time, of course, World War II is ramping up. And on the Baja coast, the Japanese owned a ton of fisheries and had a huge fishing fleet in Mexico. So it very well could have been that they wanted Steinbeck to just survey some of these sites, because back then they were concerned that the Japanese might have secret submarine bases they were building in Mexico, or even to that point that Mexico could join the Axis and turn World War II into a three-front war. So we're not really exactly sure how that panned out. Either the documents don't exist, or they've been destroyed or so classified that we'll never get an idea. But that's Steinbeck's really first brush with intelligence services. And we flash forward in 1940 a little bit, and Steinbeck is in Mexico City working on another project, and he becomes very, very distressed about German propaganda in Mexico. And so distressed that he writes an uncle of his by the name of Charles Hamilton, who works for the WPA in Washington, and says basically, we're behind the eight ball in the propaganda war. This is really, really concerning because there's blatant German propaganda on the streets of Mexico City, and we're at the precipice of war with Germany. This concerned his uncle enough that he forwarded this to FDR himself, and FDR requested a meeting with Steinbeck. And during that meeting, FDR proposed that Steinbeck literally head up a propaganda arm of the government to combat the Latin American threat with Axis countries.
Right.
Steinbeck turned that down, but did go on to work for the Foreign Information Services and for the OSS. Another thing that Steinbeck threw in the mix too, before he took up these quasi-official posts during World War II, was he had this grand plan that he presented to FDR that the United States print off tons of fake Deutschmarks and flood the German economy with phony money to collapse the German economy. And this was in late 1940, before we got involved in the Second World War.
Yeah.
And potentially could have stopped the war before it even really got started as far as America was concerned. FDR loved the idea and took it to the Secretary of Treasury and the British ambassador. They, of course, hated the idea because it's kind of like the nuclear option of economics. When you start debasing somebody's currency, that opens the door for someone else doing that to you.
Right.
And not to mention, you know, the Ford Motors and IBM, who were still in bed with the Germans at that point, and we're not really sure whether we're going to get in the war with them or not. So debasing the Deutschmark would adversely affect business as usual. So yeah. I have a feeling that was more to the point. So there were logistical concerns too. How do you get that many Deutschmarks into Germany? So the plan was struck down. Interestingly enough, the Germans were doing the exact same thing with British pounds, and up to 1944 were printing off fake pounds, and they were going to airlift them and drop them over populated areas of England to do exactly the same thing. Well, unfortunately for the Germans, air superiority was lost long before they had enough pounds to actually pull that off, and the plan never came to fruition. But Steinbeck's phony money scam comes back up after this 1953 letter, and actually shows up in a 1950 document from the CIA about economic warfare, which they specifically address using counterfeit currency to undermine a country's economy. And Steinbeck actually wrote about this and revamped it for the Cold War in the same series of articles that he wrote for Collier's Magazine that he wrote to Walter Beadle Smith about. But anyway, that's kind of getting ahead of ourselves. But Steinbeck works for these agencies in propaganda capacities. And we're left with not a whole lot of records during this period because Steinbeck was still viewed as the communist sympathizer.
Now, so, let me ask you before we proceed there, what do you think, like, how did this unfold here? Because his first novel, A Cup of Gold, is published in 1929. So that's way before he, you know, starts to get in with OSS and the military and everything there. Was it his, I guess, and I don't know if his communist sentiments were clear in his early publications or not, but is it because of his sentiments that he gets, do you think, involved in the military? Or is it that he basically is a plant as an author later in life to kind of fill a position to begin to, I have no idea here, but spread some of these ideas? What do you make of this here?
Well, first and foremost, Steinbeck was a patriot, and it's really because of the point of view and the perception of the Grapes of Wrath that kind of turned public opinion or against Steinbeck. I mean, at the time, there were public book burnings of Grapes of Wrath, and a number of libraries throughout the country banned the book. Heck, as late as 2002, there was a school system in Mississippi that banned Steinbeck's books because of profanity.
Hmm.
So Steinbeck was a lightning rod during this period. And I think John capitalized on that perception more than he was a plant, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And we'll see a little later in the late 50s that the government actually fuels this to a certain extent by taking, actually banning Steinbeck's books in State Department libraries.
Interesting.
Huh. So I think that what we're looking at is somebody that desperately wanted to serve his country. You know, Steinbeck was too young to serve in World War I. In World War II, he's stuck in these pseudo jobs for the government, never really holding an official position. He really wanted a commission in the United States Army, and actually took an assignment with the Army Air Corps to write a book called Bombs Away, and it was a story of a B-17 bomber crew. And actually got a letter of recommendation for a commission from Curtis LeMay, who was the father of strategic bombing in America. And still, Steinbeck is denied a commission in the Army. In his FBI file, we see the initial assessment of him, and everything is good from the initial investigating officer. And all of a sudden, that ends up on the desk of a lieutenant colonel by the name of Boris Posh. And Posh was the head of security for the Manhattan Project at the time. How Steinbeck's request for a commission and background check ends up on his desk, I don't know. It's curious, though. You'd think that the man that was in charge of security for the Manhattan Project would have better things to do than look into routine background checks.
Right.
And, you know, he very well might have been looking or had the oversight of special cases or celebrities during that time too. You know, there's no telling. But Posh flat out denies it and says, I really don't care what the initial investigating officer is. My opinion is, you know, Steinbeck's disloyal. He is a dangerous undercurrent in American society, and there's no way we're giving a commission. Posh actually went on to leading Project Alsos late in World War II, that they were tasked with rounding up any Nazi scientists that were involved in their nuclear program, and later on worked for the CIA trying to ferret out Soviet moles here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Posh even blacklisted Robert Oppenheimer in the 50s and testified at his trial at HUAC. So Posh was about as hardcore an anti-communist as you can get. So Posh quashes Steinbeck's hopes of getting a commission. Steinbeck tries to enlist in the Army and is denied by his home draft board in Solanas, California, much for the same reasons. And you've got to remember, the people on the draft board were the same farmers and landowners that he railed against during the Grapes of Wrath.
Right, yeah.
So he's stuck.
There's no possibility here that we're dealing with a double agent or something like that.
I don't think so.
Right.
Because during Steinbeck's time where he's floating around with these different agencies, we have Steinbeck writing The Moon Is Down, which takes a fictional European country that is invaded by a fictional foe, and is a story about the resistance movement. It's long been thought that it was Norway was the invaded country, and of course the Germans were the oppressors.
Yeah.
And Steinbeck actually, after the war, got a medal from the Norwegian king for The Moon Is Down and how it inspired his people during the war. And I think that was written at the behest of the OSS, because The Moon Is Down was dropped with weapon shipments that the government would drop to resistance movements. And that's not just happenstance. That's something that's kind of planned out. So I think the government might have actually thought Steinbeck was more valuable in doing things like that and in creating propaganda and being the writer and intellectual mover that he was, rather than being on the ground in the battlefield. So I think that could have been what blocked his aspirations to be in the Army. I think he was kind of being channeled for their own purposes.
Huh.
But Steinbeck comes back, and the stock line in his biographies is he gets really, really sick of being jerked around by the government and being denied a commission and an enlistment. So he goes to the New York Herald Tribune and says, hey, I want to be a war correspondent. Okay, great. The Herald Tribune is all over it. And they send him in 1943 to London. And eventually Steinbeck makes his way to North Africa and gets right in the thick of the Italian campaign right before the Salerno invasion. So we're talking about somebody that the United States Army has deemed a security risk, right? Well, Steinbeck gets embedded with one of the most top secret commando groups of all of World War II, the Beach Jumpers.
What? Huh.
They were led by Douglas Fairbanks Jr., the movie actor, and Fairbanks had actually gone to England and researched how the English commando structure was set up. And they were kind of the predecessors to the Navy SEALs.
Right.
And what they did was they would work deception tactics. You know, they'd land on a beach somewhere and they would scatter around sea rations and cigarette butts and make it look like there were scouting parties on little Mediterranean islands where there was no intention of anyone landing there. they go out in PT boats and they fly these huge aluminum foil radar sails to create false radar signatures to make the Germans think that there were more ships in one area than there actually were. And they, over loudspeakers, they'd play ship sounds and simulate radio traffic and, you know, all sorts of non-combat directed actions. And Steinbeck's embedded with these guys. It's kind of, once again, we kind of have the conundrum here. Why is your security risk given access to these folks?
Right. Yeah.
And once again, that's never fully explained. But once again, I think it's that effort to channel Steinbeck into the areas that the government wanted him to go.
What kind of, did he have a specialty? Is this about morale? What how are they using him exactly?
Well, I think that it's because Steinbeck had a very, very unique storytelling ability. Most of the correspondents in World War II were stuck on the who, what, when, where, and why.
I see. Yeah. Right.
Steinbeck is a masterful observer of human nature. And if you look at Steinbeck's articles that he wrote for the Herald Tribune, he talks about things like what happens on a troop ship going from the States to England. Steinbeck didn't fly to Europe. He wanted to travel on the troop ships to see what the guys went through. And he talks about the guys playing poker and how, you know, it's very cramped. And he said, you know, the one thing you can't get out of the way is your feet. He said, someone's always stepping on your feet. And it kind of, Steinbeck's writing during World War II is summed up by Ernie Pyle, who was the quintessential war correspondent, who said that once Steinbeck got to Europe, the war will finally have a soul.
He can personalize the war a bit more, perhaps, then.
Exactly. Plus, Steinbeck already knows some of the protocols of the intelligence community, working with the OSS. He knows what's sensitive. He knows what to shut up about.
Is this is, in other words, an early, you know, what we got to hear about during the invasion of Iraq with the embedded journalists and everything else. This is like a precursor to that almost in a way.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that was very, very prominent in World War II. But Steinbeck wasn't your typical correspondent. You know, we look at people like Hemingway. Hemingway was a correspondent during World War II. And he decided to go rogue and was in France right before Paris was retaken. And he actually found a group of Maquis, or the French resistance, and he went off with them and actually performed actions on his own. Hemingway's son was in the OSS, and so Hemingway was kind of seen as part of the family. And Hemingway was actually called to carpet on that and was taken in front of the Inspector General of the Third Army for taking up arms, which was a serious no-no for war correspondents because you're then a combatant and you have no protection under the Geneva Convention.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Steinbeck did the exact same thing, except he was not nearly as boisterous about it. The beach jumpers would sneak an extra Tommy gun in the PT boats when they go out, and John would very quietly slip off his war correspondent's arm badge and take part of any action that they were part of, and was actually, according to one of his biographers, was recommended for the Silver Star for an action on an Italian island in Ventennany, where the beach jumpers bluffed a garrison of about some reports say 300, some say 500 Germans and Italians into surrendering right after the Italian surrender. And they only had maybe 40 or 50 guys and had a very, very tense night on the island, trading gunfire back and forth between the Germans before the next morning. There was actually some OSS agents along with the beach jumpers then. And one of the heirs to the Ringling Brothers circus empire talked the German garrison commander down into surrendering. But Steinbeck was part of that action, but he was denied a Silver Star. And once again, one of his major biographers said that it was because he was a civilian that he couldn't get a Silver Star.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of wrong. I hate to plug Jackson Benson like this, but there are a number of examples in World War II where civilians were awarded the Silver Star. In the Navy manuals today, there is a procedure for civilians getting military medals. So I think what we're looking at here too is Steinbeck was put in for the Silver Star and was denied it because nobody wanted to publicly admit that a war correspondent took up arms.
Right. Yeah.
So Steinbeck's kind of in the soup again, and he ends up covering the Salerno invasion. And that happened right on the heels of the invasion of Intenene. And magically, Steinbeck leaves the European theater after that. This was in August, September, October of 1943. And Steinbeck's contract was up in December with the Herald Tribune. And I believe it was in mid-October Steinbeck actually leaves London and comes back to the States, offering no other explanation than, I've had enough of war.
Hmm.
Don't think that's quite the case.
Right.
And there was other evidence, too, that Steinbeck was still working with the government at that point. He talks about working on a film for the Army Services Supply Corps, which, you know, of course, they do exactly what it sounds like. They, from everything from beans to bullets, they supplied.
Right.
And Steinbeck was working on a film that highlighted their contribution to the war effort, and even spent about a week with the general staff of the entire SOS division that supplied all of Europe. And once again, a security risk is given access to service and supply. How does this happen? It happens once again because the government or the powers that be wanted Steinbeck to go in a specific direction, and they opened up those opportunities to him to be of service to them.
Do you think he's aware of this fully and agrees to it, or is he being played?
No. I think he's being played at this point.
Right.
Because, you know, going back to his commission, he wrote his editor, Pat Cavici, in summer of 1942, that he was definitely getting an Army commission, and it was just a matter of months before it was coming through. But we also see that Steinbeck's investigation on his background didn't happen until the middle of 1943, a year later. So Steinbeck's being sold a bill of goods to this point and actually isn't officially denied the commission until after he's a war correspondent. So the official thinking about the timing and Steinbeck's mindset during this time period doesn't match up. So I think Steinbeck was being played because his letters indicate this hopefulness about becoming an Army officer, and then all of a sudden he's despondent and he's going to become a war correspondent. So I think those avenues were shut down and he was channeled without his knowledge.
Hmm. Now, I don't mean to jump ahead here, then if there's more, of course, to talk about in the chronology here, but the letter that he writes in 1952, you know, it's almost 10 years after, you know, by the time he was in World War II in the service there, but this seems to be on a much lighter note, perhaps, shall we say. It's maybe it's an admission to the fact that, all right, I'm willing to do some, you know, work for you guys here again. Or is there code within the letter? And if so, it was just communicating over letter, you know, standard procedure at that point, do you think?
Well, and that's interesting too. If we look at what Beadle Smith says to Steinbeck, there's one very telling statement in there. He says, particularly those which might be overlooked in routine reports. How in God's name would Steinbeck know what a routine CIA report was?
Right.
And in Steinbeck's letter, he mentions Herbert Baynard Swoop. And these are two very cryptic statements. I'll read them directly. They're only two sentences. I saw Herbert Baynard Swoop recently, and he told me that your health had improved. I hope this is so. I also wear the Lou for 52 button concealed under the lapel, as that shy candidate suggests. Now, Herbert Baynard Swoop really is one of the fathers of modern journalism. Everybody gives a credit to William Randolph Hearst, but Swoop created the op-ed piece. He also kind of created the framework for syndication. So a lot of the nuts and bolts of the newspaper business, Swoop is responsible for. And at this point in Swoop's life, he's retired from the newspaper business, and he was this larger-than-life, incredible gambler who threw these lavish parties in the 20s that actually were the basis for F. Scott Fitzgerald's party scenes in The Great Gatsby.
Right.
There's also a connection between Swoop and the CIA, too. And that's another long story. But I think Steinbeck dropping Swoop's name as kind of a wink, wink, Swoop told me to contact you. Now, the Lou for 52 thing is a little more cryptic and doesn't make a bit of sense whatsoever. There was a Secretary of Defense named Lewis Johnson in the early 1950s who was ousted from his post for the Task Force Smith debacle in Korea. And what happened then in the very, very early days of the Korean War, Johnson had said, I tell you what, we'll slap together a battalion or two from Japan. We'll send them over to Korea. The North Koreans will see that the Americans here and they'll turn tail and run. Well, that resulted in the deaths of over 200 servicemen and was a huge public relations disaster. And Lewis Johnson was planning on running for president in 1952, but his political aspirations were quashed in 1950. So why would Steinbeck mention this almost a footnote in politics to Beadle Smith?
Right.
Once again, it's either some kind of code, or it's just Steinbeck is so familiar with Beadle Smith that it's just kind of an inside joke. And I think where that connection comes in is we flash back a little bit to 1947. Steinbeck and Robert Capa, who is one of the quintessential war photographers of all time. You might have seen, there's a picture, famous picture of his that he took during the Spanish Civil War of a soldier being shot. And his arms are in the air and one leg is kicked up. But Capa snapped that right at the instant when the bullet struck.
Right.
Anyway, Capa is one of those other larger than life figures in the world of journalism. And him and Steinbeck are drinking one night and say, hey, this would be a great idea if we called up the New York Herald Tribune again. And why don't we go to Russia and write about the Russian people, and you can photographic, and I can do a book, and it'll be great. So Steinbeck pitches the idea, and at a time when the Iron Curtain has just fallen, nobody has been able to get into the Soviet Union or the interior of the Soviet Union since the end of World War II. Journalists at that time were limited to being in Moscow unless they had special dispensation from the Russian government to go somewhere very specifically to cover a story. We're looking at a very, very young CIA at this point with no intelligence assets inside the Soviet Union.
Right.
And Steinbeck decides to take this trip and pulls it off. Him and Capa get there, and oddly enough, there's nobody from the embassy to greet him at the airport. There's nobody from the Herald Tribune there, and they're kind of on their own for two or three days. They're living off ration tickets from other journalists, and they're kind of pulling a Hunter S. Thompson, and they're becoming the story at this point.
Right.
But they do a Fear and Loathing in Moscow tour for about 4 days. And finally, they kind of get their official sanction, and they attach themselves to a Soviet official and pretty much told that they can just about go anywhere they want, which this is unprecedented at the time.
Yeah.
For an American journalist to be able to do this. Well, also, right as they're getting their credentials, the United States Embassy in Moscow says, "Oh, crap, we forgot you were coming. Why don't you come to dinner?" And guess who the ambassador to the Soviet Union is then? Walter Beadle Smith.
Really? Huh.
So if we look at a Russian journal and we take that into consideration in the entire political and intelligence machinery of the time, we can pretty much surmise that either at that dinner or before, Steinbeck was courted by either the State Department or the Central Intelligence Group, which was the interim between the OSS and the CIA, to simply keep his eyes and ears open during that trip.
Yeah.
And it very well could have been at that dinner party that night that Beadle Smith took him aside and said, "Hey, here's what's going on. I need your help." And that probably started the relationship with Steinbeck and Smith. But if we look at a Russian journal, and this is the book, of course, that chronicles that trip, there are a lot of clues in there that Steinbeck was actually gathering intelligence. He visits the Stalingrad tractor factory where the heaviest battle happened during the Stalingrad campaign in World War II. And they're producing tractors at this point. And Steinbeck actually laments the fact that he can't get better production figures for that facility. He mentions what type of machinery they're using. He talks about them melting down German tanks still because they can't get steel. Steinbeck talks about bomb damage assessment and how he there's not a lot of repair that's been done throughout the Soviet Union from World War II. He also talks about how rubles are being exchanged on the black market and what their exchange rates are. And probably most telling of all, Steinbeck is invited to an air show in Moscow, and him and Kappa are there, and they really want to go down on the flight line and see the Russian aircraft, because Steinbeck says, "Kappa and I didn't know an airplane from a hole in the ground," which is a patent lie. Steinbeck spent 3 months with the B-17 bomber crew.
Right.
And yeah, flew on every aircraft that the Army Air Corps had. He even took flight lessons in 1940.
Why is Moscow allowing this? Why is he a literary celebrity even in Russia at this stage? And people are like, "Yay, great. You know, we love this guy."
Well, pretty much. I think they wanted to be able to use Steinbeck for their own propaganda purposes.
Right, right.
And depending upon who you ask and what accounts you read, they were either very successful at that or not very successful. But the Russians had the same perception of Steinbeck that the American people did, that he was sympathetic to the communist cause, which, once again, can be no further from the truth. His son Tom told me that Steinbeck didn't worry about American communists because they couldn't get out of bed in time to attend rallies. And Steinbeck writes to his buddy, Swedish painter Bo Badeski. This is in the late 40s or early 50s,
mm-hmm,
after this first or the second trip he's made to Russia, that he was in Russia a few years ago, and if the communists are allowed to succeed, it'll plunge the world into a dark ages the likes humanity has never known.
That's right. Yeah.
So he's pretty clear about his stance on communism in his personal life. In his public life, it doesn't really matter to him too much what people think about him. You know, it mattered to a certain extent, but he really didn't care. And I think he he kind of kept that up once again to keep this cover. So the Russians during this trip were thinking, ah, he's a friend of the people. He'll tell the story, you know, like it is and show the Americans exactly what a great state the Soviet Union is.
Right.
Well, Steinbeck did tell it like it was. Russia was a broken country that was struggling to survive at that point after World War II. And Steinbeck portrays that very, very well during a Russian journal. But there, as a intelligence guide, a Russian journal is gold. And I was able to speak with a former CIA agent during this project. And I refer to him as TC in the book. And I unfortunately cannot name his name. Right. I know everybody's going, yeah, sure. Everybody talks to a CIA agent.
Right.
This guy, if I explained who he was, there would be no doubt. But, and I didn't even realize that he was an agent or an ex-intelligence officer when I first spoke to him. It was on a totally unrelated matter. And some things that he said, I just took a wild stab and turned out I was right when I was talking to him. But anyway, he was a intelligence officer from the Eisenhower to Reagan administrations. So we're talking about this exact time period. And he didn't know if Steinbeck specifically was an asset and didn't have any insight into that. But he did tell me a number of interesting things, one of which was a Russian journal was something akin to a spook summer reading list and was passed around by senior field officers to junior field officers to get a feel for what the interior of the Soviet Union was. So if Steinbeck didn't write a Russian journal from an intelligence perspective, the CIA certainly was using it for their own purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I think that it was one of those things that either Steinbeck volunteered just like he did in 1952 or was approached, one of the two. And that sets up his later service with it during this 1952 trip.
Huh. Well, this is very interesting. You know, I want to get more into, we got to get into Operation Mockingbird, and it kind of, I've been very interested in what happens in Europe, you know, after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan and how the CIA is in there and trying to, you know, take over control in a lot of regards. I mean, we have stay behind armies of NATO and everything else, but the environment changes here. And this is just very interesting story to hear about as you have, you know, an active, you know, participatory member, if you will, in this progress a little bit with, and specifically then that you have a literary celebrity like Steinbeck involved in this. But, you know, before we carry on here, Brian, why don't we, you know, take a little short break here. I want to give out some details, of course, about the book and about your publishing company as well. You guys have some great publications out there. So please give out the details about the book, how people can pick up copies of this, and then tell us more about the publisher.
Sure. Anybody can go to SteinbeckCitizenSpy.com. To view these documents and read an excerpt from the book. And it also has a lot of the places that the book is available, all the usual suspects online, you know, the Amazons, the Barnes and Nobles. Actually, Walmart's website picked the book up, which kind of shocked me, but, you know, that's great. Anyway, but you can go there, or if you even want to fact check me, all these documents are available on the CIA's website, including a couple of documents that they released after my publication. So that just further support my theories here. But you can go there, or you can go to my publishing company's website, which is gravedistractions.com. And we're an independent publisher that we really are not genre specific. We really, really want to help authors that believe in their work. And we've got a number of great books out there from biblical scholars like Robert Eisenman to Ancient Aliens star Michael Carter. So something for everybody at the Grave Distraction site. So check it out.
Indeed, very good. SteinbeckCitizenSpy.com and GraveDistractions.com. We're going to have these links up on the website, of course. But much more is coming up here, so stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back with Brian. Thank you.
Band, dressing while right near to me.